The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Right. So if you say it was to make America stronger, you know, the goal of America is to make America stronger, or it's to uphold international norms. You look back and you say, OK, Iraq clearly didn't do that. Now that, you know, that's a presumption that's, you know, rebuttable. If you go back to the history and you see, oh, well, they had a careful plan and that would lead to actually the U.S., you know, having greater power or strength due to Iraq. You know, they would have, they had a plan to seize the oil or something, you know, or to do something else, but it didn't work. And then you look, but then you look at the history and then it only hurts more the theory of grand strategy. I mean, the lack of thought that was put into Iraq and Afghanistan at the very beginning and the key decisions. I mean, it's shocking.
I'm Jack Goldsmith, and this is the Lawfare podcast of June 7, 2022. What, if any, theory of international relations best explains U.S. foreign policy outcomes? Why, for example, did President Biden withdraw American forces from Afghanistan, re-engage Iran on the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, and impose harsher-than-expected sanctions on Russia, and gave more-than-expected support to Ukraine following the Russian invasion? I sat down with Richard Hanania, the president of the Center for the Study of Partisanship and Ideology, whose new book, Public Choice Theory and the Illusion of Grand Strategy, seeks to provide answers to these types of questions. We discussed Hanania's view that academic theories about American grand strategy cannot explain important U.S. foreign policy outcomes, and his argument that these outcomes are better explained by public choice theory, and especially by the dominant influences on the presidency of government contractors, the national security bureaucracy, and foreign governments. We also discussed whether realist complaints about these influences are consistent with realist premises about how to discern the national interest and the value, if any, of international relations theorizing. It's the Lawfare Podcast, June 7, Public Choice Theory and American Foreign Policy.
Richard, your book is called Public Choice Theory and the Illusion of Grand Strategy: How Generals, Weapons Manufacturers, and Foreign Governments Shape American Foreign Policy. And that's a pretty accurate description of the thesis of the book. I would put it this way. You think that international relations grand strategy theories don't do a good job of explaining U.S. foreign policy outcomes. You think public choice theory, which is basically an economics-based theory of group influence on government decisions, does a better job of explaining foreign policy outcomes. And in particular, you focus on three groups as having especially powerful influence: government contractors, the national security bureaucracy, and foreign governments. Is that a fair summary? And if not, tell me what I got wrong.
No, that's pretty much a perfect summary of the book.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Talk to us about what grand strategy is. What is that? It's a term in the IR literature. Tell us what that is, and tell us what the U.S. grand strategy is said to be.
So grand strategy is the idea that a state is putting together its various forms of power, its various forms of ways of influencing the world. That's diplomatic, military power, economic power, towards certain ends. And it doesn't say, you know, the theory that there's a grand strategy doesn't say about what that strategy is. It could be ideological. It could be, you know, often it's thought to be something having to do with protecting national security or advancing the, you know, economic or material interests of the the country. It doesn't necessarily have to be that, although that's the way it's often thought of in the literature. You know, that's the idea. And then the American grad strategy, I mean, it's basically, this is sort of the, you know, whenever you're reading analysis of foreign policy, it's not just you're reading professors of international relations. When you're reading like a New York Times article that is a news analysis or something in foreign policy or a report by a think tank, it's sort of the, you know, the water in which, you know, we're fish swimming in the water. This is sort of the assumption there. And then the specifics of American grad strategy, I mean, there's generally two, you know, people have all kinds of ideas of what causes foreign policy, but I think, you know, people who are the most prominent individuals and most influential people writing on the subject or thinking about the subject. There's liberal internationalism, the idea that the U.S. is defending some kind of international norms. You know, it's advancing international law. And then there's the idea of primacy, which is the idea that the United States basically just wants power to have power to be able to maintain its influence in the world in order to achieve its own interests. And that means things like you know, heading off any potential challengers, any potential rival superpower, and, you know, and otherwise dealing with, you know, threats that may emerge on sort of the outskirts of, you know, ungoverned spaces, things like that. So these are basically the grand strategy is sort of the framework. And then these are specifics to what people generally think of as American grand strategy.
So let me question you about that. I mean, these are, as you say, these, you're not inventing these categories. You're taking them from the literature, more or less. I mean, there, as you say, there are different accounts for what the ends the United States pursues. And most of the accounts include the two things you mentioned, military primacy and liberal internationalism. Military primacy seems kind of obvious, but I'm curious about liberal internationalism. It doesn't seem, it seems obviously not to be, at least as you just described it, as a kind of rule-based international order, complying with international law. It doesn't, it seems obviously not to be a kind of party transcendent end that the United States pursues. I mean, you, the first footnote of the book, or at least in the first chapter, you have a footnote that maybe Trump, you seem to suggest by a citation to, I think, Barry Posen's piece, that maybe Trump wasn't committed to liberal internationalism, but I don't think George W. Bush was either. He violated lots of international laws. He was roundly accused of being hostile to international law and institutions. He withdrew from a lot of international institutions. So can you just zero in on that stated end and tell us, you know, is there really a consensus in the IR literature that that is one of the aims of U.S. foreign policy?
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways to sort of understand this idea of liberal norms. So in a certain way, yeah, the Bush administration was not like the Biden administration. Everything it does, it justifies, you know, we're the leaders of the free world, international norms, rules-based international order. You know, that's sort of one of their favorite phrases. The Bush administration, you know, was much more willing, you know, as people criticize them for, to do things unilaterally, to sometimes violate international law, you know, most obvious case being the war in Iraq. Yeah, that's true. But I think, you know, even the Bush administration, I mean, it was trying to, you know, enforce some kind of liberal order. I mean, maybe it's not a cooperative one, but it's you know, the entire Bush doctrine that came about, you know, in 2003, 2004, and to some extent guided the administration, was about democratization. I mean, this became the entire justification for the Iraq war. So there was something about liberal norms. It wasn't about, you know, maybe they didn't have too much respect for the UN or the European, you know, the EU, you know, Court of Human Rights. Maybe like they didn't care about that stuff or the opinion of, you know, international NGOs, but there was, you know, this kind of, you know, my argument is basically these aren't really the, you know, the grand strategies. This isn't right, like, you know, the best way to understand it. But I would say the Bush administration justification, there was something based in something like liberal international norms. The Trump administration, I mean, you know, they were, you know, holding hands with the Saudis, and at that point, you know, they weren't even pretending to care. But I do think the Bush administration, there are a lot of continuities with the Democratic administration that came before and after.
So just to pick up on something you said, and to be clear, you're not claiming that this is what drives U.S. foreign policy, but I'm just trying to understand what the conventional wisdom is. It just seems to me, and this is the last I'll say on it, and you can respond if you want, it seems to me that thinking about it as the rules-based international order is just so obviously wrong. I mean, maybe it's democratization, maybe it's promoting the U.S. understanding of rules in international trade and market-based stuff. But it just seems to me at the broad level that you describe some of the literature describing it, it seems so obviously wrong that I'm surprised that that's the claim in the literature. Let me be clear. So obviously wrong as a description of U.S. foreign policy that transcends administrations.
Yeah, I don't know if I do have some, you know, quotes in there from like people like, John Eikenberry, you know, you say it's obvious that that's not what the U.S. is doing. I mean, but, you know, the Biden administration can't stop talking about it. So they must think it's, you know, they either believe it or they must think it's at least convincing to some people. It's, you know, it's probably not you read a lot of the more sophisticated international relations theorists can look at American foreign policy and say, you know, that's clearly not what we're doing. But, you know, some important people do apparently believe what we're doing. So, you know, it has to be, you know, the argument has to be addressed.
No, I agree. My point is not that I do think the Biden administration thinks that's what they're doing to some level. And I do think that's what they say. And same with Obama. But I don't think it was true of the last two Republican administrations. That's my only point. I think it was obviously not true, but we can leave that. Because it's not really relevant to your claim, or it's not dispositive of your claim. So that, and just to make sure I understand, the target of the book are these IR theorists. I mean, you're basically claiming your theory beats their theory. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. But I think the IR theorists, I think their framework is the general, you know, is the general understanding. You'll read, you know, like just a news story about American foreign policy, you know, and then they'll say things like, you know, for example, they'll talk about the U.S. strategy towards China, and they, you know, they'll tell a very neat story where in the 1990s, the U.S. had this ideology. You know, the ideology doesn't have to be consistent over time, but the idea was there was a strategy. The U.S. had a belief that China was going to become liberalized and it was going to become democratic and we engagement. And now, you know, a bunch of stuff happened. And now we decided that that wasn't the best approach. Now we've got to get tough with China. So when you tell that story, it's not like sophisticated in like an IR theorist sense, but there is a sense of like there's a decision maker somewhere with actual long-term goals trying to get something out of the U.S.-China relationship. And some people in the government, I think, are doing that, but I don't think that's necessarily the best understanding of what's happened, say, in the relationship with China or war on terror or like all these other, you know, foreign policy questions.
So you basically just said it was not just academics, it's basically the elite journalistic culture and the way foreign policy gets discussed in public. But do you think that the people in the government say or think they're operating on this theory? I guess the Democratic administrations, I guess they do on both points. What do you think?
I don't have as much experience with people in government as I do with academics or academic literature, even, you know, reading journalistic accounts or think tank reports on what's going on. You know, more generally, is a sort of a question of human nature. I think people tend to believe, you know, they tend to convince themselves of the things that they need to believe or want to believe for self-interested reasons. You know, Robert Trivers' evolutionary theory here is, you know, something that's had a major influence on my thinking. So I tend to believe that as a general matter, government officials, like most people, convince themselves of certain things. Now, it's possible that, you know, in some cases, you know, it's possible that they don't. And if, you know, if they don't, if that's not the dominant understanding within government, it's still, you know, worth going to everyone else and saying, hey, this is really not what they're doing. You know, one of my arguments in my book is actually this is sort of flattering. This is a sort of a self-flattering portrait of American foreign policy. So people in government would sort of, you know, have an interest, whether it's, you know, a conscious, you know, sort of misleading the public or not, they would have an interest in sort of believing this. So I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, I wouldn't be surprised actually either way, but yeah, the argument doesn't depend on, you know, whether actually people within government believe the story of grand strategy.
Okay, so before we get to your public choice account, can you just tell us, you know, briefly why you find IR grand strategy theories lacking in terms of explaining U.S. foreign policy outcomes? There are lots of examples in the book. Could you just give us a few?
Sure. So, I mean, I came at this, I was interested in foreign affairs for a long time before I went to graduate school and, you know, studied it as an academic discipline. And, you know, I thought a lot of the things they were doing in American foreign policy really didn't make sense. I mean, my initial experience in paying attention to politics and foreign affairs was really the war on terror. And, you know, the connections between, for example, why we said we were going into Iraq and Afghanistan and how those those wars, you know, unfolded was just sort of so, you know, there was such a discrepancy there. And when I went back, I read the history. I mean, there was even a bigger discrepancy than I thought. So, I mean, this is an example of people using sort of the grand strategy framework. They'll say, you know, this is smart people. People in academia or people in journalism will tell the story. The neoconservatives in the Bush administration wanted to democratize Iraq because they had some kind of, you know, ideology that this was going to change the Middle East. I mean, there's been entire books written on sort of, you know, what the ideology was driving this. And then you go back and you look at the history, and it doesn't appear that anybody was thinking in those terms. I mean, maybe somebody within the administration, there you could point to one or two people. But no, I mean, they were basically thinking in terms of, you know, going after Saddam Hussein. They were thinking in terms of sort of preventing more terrorist attacks. And, you know, it's sort of, in some ways, it's sort of hard to know what they were thinking. But then it's very clear that the idea of the Bush Doctrine emerges in the aftermath of the inability to find weapons of mass destruction. So you can do this with text analysis. Doug Fife, who was in the administration, who didn't like the, you know, this sort of pivot to this democratization idea. He talks about this in his memoirs, and he, you know, just analyzes Bush's speeches, and other political scientists have done this too. And so you have this, you know, you have the Bush Doctrine, right? And then people come to believe that's sort of, you know, why the whole reason we were in Iraq. The Afghanistan war is another one. I mean, we go in there, for obvious reasons after September 11th. And then you go back and you read the history of like how we decided to, you know, build a democracy around Karzai. I mean, it got zero attention. I mean, this is from the accounts from the top of the administration. I mean, this is the accounts of the memoirs, people like Zalmay Khalilzad, who say, you know, there was basically no attention at the top of the government. There's no evidence that, you know, Bush or Cheney were thinking about it. I mean, but then they have this Bush Doctrine, this thing, which they adopted because of the failure to find WMDs in Iraq. And this sort of, you know, Afghanistan just drags along. There's no like good opportunity to leave. And so you just sort of, you know, you just stay. And then that becomes about democracy. And then, you know, that goes on for another 15 years. At that point. So it was the war on terror, I think, was a big one. I think it's easier to understand it just sort of a series of improvisations, depending on, you know, political interests and public opinion and, you know, sometimes ideology. Somebody grabs sort of it's like a giant, you know, the government's like a giant ship, and somebody can grab the wheel and like, you know, turn it for a little direction. So maybe the neoconservatives had their little, they had their moment in the sun, but it wasn't necessarily that wasn't necessarily driving American foreign policy, you know, for over the long term.
Before you go on to another example, can I just ask one question about that? Isn't the claim that the two supposed motivators of U.S. action, preserving liberal hegemony or liberal internationalism and maintaining military primacy, isn't the claim ultimately that those don't explain what happened because these were disastrous wars, especially in Iraq, and they certainly, the Iraq war certainly didn't uphold liberal internationalism? Is that the claim?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's I think decent evidence for the claim, right? So if you say it was to make America stronger, you know, the goal of America is to make America stronger, or it's to uphold international norms, you look back and you say, okay, Iraq clearly didn't do that. Now that, you know, that's a presumption that's, you know, rebuttable if you go back to the history and you see, oh, well, they had a careful plan. And that would lead to actually the U.S., you know, having greater power or strength due to Iraq. You know, they had a plan to seize the oil or something, you know, or to do something else, but it didn't work. And then you look at the history, and then it only hurts more the theory of grand strategy. I mean, the lack of thought that was put into Iraq and Afghanistan at the very beginning and the key decisions. I mean, it's shocking. I go through it in the book. And this is really, I mean, this is such a motivating example because these were the things that, this was the foreign policy question, you know, in the early 2000s that the government was paying the most attention to. So if grand strategy is not there and sort of trying to uphold it, either in uphold international norms or advance American power, if you don't see it there, I mean, it's going to be probably very hard to see it anywhere. Exactly. I mean, I think that's a good way to look at it. Like, okay, does this stuff advance American interests? Okay. And then if you say no, then, well, did they have a good reason to think that? And in this case, they most certainly, I think, did not.
But even, you know, many of the grand theorists that you're criticizing in the book would have agreed with you. We agreed with you. Mearsheimer and Walt were famously opposed, for example, to the intervention in Iraq, precisely on the grounds that it wouldn't serve the military primacy interest and it would have the opposite impact. So I don't think that's inconsistent with your theory, but what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, I think this is a critique of Mersheimer and Walt that I think is fair in the sense that they, you know, they have what I think is supposed to be a descriptive theory. And, you know, Mersheimer, I mean, he, you know, they explicitly, you know, say this, but it all, they spend most of their, at least their public work is based on influencing American foreign policy, you know, so it's, you know, but then you listen to Mersheimer too, at the same time, he also does have this sort of deterministic streak too. So, you know, I've seen him, he's written that the U.S. will in the end defend Taiwan just because sort of, you know, the laws of, you know, the sort of his framework of understanding international relations says that China is, you know, the great threat to the U.S. It's the only one that objectively can have as much power and potentially threaten it. So the U.S. in the end will confront China, you know, and it will fight Taiwan. But then it's like, you know, if you look back at the war on terror, you know, Mersheimer will acknowledge the U.S. did not act in accordance with the theories of realism. So the question is, like, why now that, you know, that the we're going to turn attention to the China question, why won't these same pathologies manifest themselves? And, you know, he might have an answer, something to do with, you know, maybe having an actual hegemonic threat, you know, potential hegemonic threat, you know, that could potentially, you know, focus the mind and focus the country in a way that something like the war on terror didn't. But I mean, you know, the rise of China has been foreseeable for a very long time. So if he thinks, you know, we've been maybe not taking China seriously enough all this time, like, yeah, I don't know exactly what the point is where we start doing so by some, you know, sort of just by some sort of natural law or some kind of, you know, just inherent force of the power relationship between the two countries. I think you're right. I think you're right that, you know, realism is, you know, at least the realists who are making, you know, public arguments about this, I think there is a bit of a contradiction there. And they are, you know, they do, like you said, they do acknowledge that the U.S. often doesn't act, you know, in accordance with realist theories. And I'm sort of puzzled in how they reconcile this.
So I'll come back to, I want to come back to Mersheimer and Walt after we talk about public choice theory, but just give us one or two more examples, if you could.
I don't talk about it in the book much. Maybe I should have, because you know, I think the events have gotten, you know, I think the recent events with Russia and Ukraine are in a way very, you know, consistent with the theory I put forth. So I mean, the U.S. is you know, the U.S. is basically expanding NATO. It's not really, you know, thinking about why. I mean, it's not really, you know, there's really no debate about it. I mean, the, you know, George Kennan and these other people are saying it's going to, you know, lead to something bad. You know, and even like, you know, you could say that there was a theory, you know, in the 1990s, you know, this maybe, you know, they were trying to check Russian power, they were trying to go after Russia. You know, there's no real strong evidence from that at the time. It seems like the NATO expansion in the 1990s was done with little thought. There was just some vague understanding that you know, democracy is good and capitalism is good, and bringing these countries, you know, into the fold, you know, is a good thing. I mean, very little consideration for American security interests or how, you know, bringing Hungary, Czech Republic, and Poland, these other countries necessarily defend the United States. And then, you know, the U.S., Maidan happens, the situation in Ukraine happens, and it's not clear that, you know, at any point there was a decision, you know, to try to bring Ukraine into this stuff. It just sort of, you know, it's sort of, there's the NGOs that they're working. There's people on the Russia desk who have their own, you know, sort of ideas of people in the State Department and the federal bureaucracy who have their own ideas about the way U.S. policy towards Russia works. And they're sort of at odds with Trump, who has a very sort of different idea of NATO and what the U.S. should be doing in Eastern Europe. And then, you know, we end up in a situation, I think the politics sort of gets ahead of itself because the, you know, the U.S. gets closer to Russia. The U.S. feels like it cannot back down at that point because, you know, we have these commitments. I mean, nobody would probably think about Estonia or Latvia any more than we think about Georgia, but Georgia, you know, the commitment is there for the Baltic countries. It's not there for Georgia. So therefore, you know, I think we sort of stumbled into something here, even though I think if the U.S. could have, you know, come to some kind of agreement on NATO expansion and the Russian security concerns, it was probably, you know, too late by early 2022. And then another one, I think the rise of China is just a very important one. You know, the idea that the U.S. trading with China, like the idea that everyone believed that the U.S. would trade with China, therefore China would become democratic. I mean, it was a rhetorical point. I don't know. you know, it's hard to see why people would have thought that. And it's hard to actually see like other examples of that kind of thinking in American foreign policy, because we have a sanctions regime that basically has the opposite idea, that you're going to pressure countries, that you're going to cut them off from the international system, and that somehow will induce better behavior. Well, when it came to China, we took the opposite strategy. And I think it's better explained by the fact that, you know, there was the most massive somebody called it the most massive lobbying campaign, you know, in the history of American big business to bring China into the WTO, just to open up China. And, you know, the U.S. Did do that. And then, you know, everything else that happened with China, you know, it becoming more powerful, it's starting to push its weight around. I mean, all that was completely foreseeable once this country started growing economically. And now we're turning toward a more confrontational, you know, the confrontational approach to China. I do think, you know, in the Trump, this grand strategy thing, whether it exists or not, it's sort of on a spectrum. I mean, some things look like nothing like a grand strategy, and some things do look like a grand strategy. So I think the war on terror is an extreme case of something that is not a grand strategy. Something like sanctions towards Cuba or Venezuela, you know, there seems to be very little, you know, strategy here. Like why, you know, the sanctions, it seems to be domestic, especially a case of Cuba, for example, you know, a lot of domestic politics. I think that the China one, you know, I think, you know, I think we're more, you know, the Trump administration in particular, they were more inclined towards the grand strategy sort of end of things. I mean, particularly they've gone after Huawei, the U.S., trying to sort of build alliances in the region. You know, they sort of you have a lot of the publicization of a Chinese atrocities, Chinese human rights violations. So that's another one. I mean, so I think we are shifting maybe towards something resembling a grand strategy towards China. The Soviet Union, the U.S., at least in the early days of the Cold War, I mean, there was, you know, I think something resembling a strategy. I don't think it's been, you know, the way we've dealt with China up until this point. And maybe I just answered my question about Mearsheimer, because what I'm saying, I think he says grand strategy is more useful when thinking about great powers relating to other great powers. And, you know, maybe it's not in everything else. So maybe me and him are not as far apart as I would have thought.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to that in a second. So most of our listeners will understand what public choice theory is, but could you just run through your account as quickly as you can, and with regard to the three groups that you think are most dominant, and explain, you know, what you think the drivers of U.S. foreign policy are, and then maybe take one of your examples, China or Ukraine, and explain how you think your theory explains U.S. foreign policy behavior better there.
Sure. So, you know, public choice theory is basically you're taking the tools of economics and you're using it to understand politics. And the tools of economics starts with the idea that, you know, you could imagine there are rational, self-interested actors. And then you assume they're seeking their own interests, and then you sort of build a framework for understanding politics or a policy area. You know, and one of the most important ideas in public choice theory is the idea that groups with concentrated interests get their way over groups with diffuse interests. So if you have a tariff, you know, question about a tariff, and not having a tariff benefits every consumer, you know, a little bit, but putting the tariff on to some goods coming into the country really helps a domestic producer. The domestic producer is going to have an advantage. I think, you know, something like public choice theories, you know, some kind of political, maybe they don't call it that in like political science. I think that is our sort of default understanding of politics. I mean, so when you think about healthcare or you think about immigration, I give those examples in the book, you know, people don't think in terms of grand strategy. We understand the healthcare system is a mess. We understand the immigration system is a mess. We understand it's a bunch of historically contingent decisions based on, you know, politics and other things that have gotten us to this point. So I think foreign policy is best understood in that framework rather than the grand strategy framework. And so the first thing you do, or one of the first things you do when you apply public choice theory to an area, you look for where are the groups with a concentrated interest in a policy outcome. So there are a few, the government itself is an interest group. I mean, so like, you know, the Pentagon, the NSA, the CIA, I mean, there's plenty of examples of them influencing American American politics. I mean, often, you know, they can have different opinions about what American foreign policy should be. One thing you should expect them to all agree on is, you know, not to ever cut the federal, you know, the defense budget or the CIA budget or anything like that. You'd expect them to want to sort of at least maintain their own power and influence. And that's, you know, that's what we do find. That can manifest itself in a more hawkish foreign policy. I think that has been the case in the last few administrations on Afghanistan in particular. You know, the Pentagon was much more inclined to want to stay than, you know, either any of the last three presidents. I mean, Obama, Trump, and Biden. And, you know, there's, you know, you can, the histories of these are very interesting because it wasn't like that, you know, the presidents were really, really, really in deep disagreement with the Pentagon, with the national security bureaucracy, but they were doing their own thing and they were trying to, you know, raise the political costs of pulling back from the war, which, you know, to a certain extent, each of those presidents wanted to do, particularly Trump and then Biden, who was finally able to do it successfully. So you have them. You also have the contractors, the weapons manufacturers, some of these companies like Raytheon and Lockheed. I mean, they're major corporations. They're almost, you know, pretty much all their revenue comes from government contracts. So this is the easiest, you know, this is going back to Eisenhower's idea of the military industrial complex. This is sort of maybe the prototypical case of what you'd expect a group to have an influence on policymaking from, you know, this should be in public choice textbooks. I mean, something like Raytheon or Lockheed. And, you know, these things, you know, these companies, you know, their methods of influence are very interesting because it's not like they just, you know, it's not like selling soap or it's not like selling deodorant or like getting a tariff, like to justify defense budgets. You have to have, you know, some kind of philosophical or, you know, argument or something in the national interest. I mean, people pay attention to it. And, you know, what these groups do is they do old fashioned normal politicking things like providing jobs and then having, you know, congressmen and representatives, senators, trying to influence them to act on their behalf. But then at the same time, you know, they do a lot of funding for sort of ideological work. So a lot of think tanks have funding that comes from these defense contractors. I mean, some things are, you know, just like you wouldn't have think, like the Project for a New American Century in the 1990s, it was a Lockheed executive. I mean, who was one of the initial founders of that. The guy named Bruce Jackson was also influential in lobbying for a lot of the Eastern European countries to get into the, to ultimately they successfully got into NATO in the 1990s. So this is another important one. I mean, these first two, the federal bureaucracy and the government contractors, there's a sort of a symbiotic relationship now because basically all three and four star generals at this point, or virtually all of them, go work for some kind of defense contractors after they retire. And you can see, you know, sort of the interest that's created here. And it's not just, you know, it's also high level civilians have also, you know, landed somewhere nicely, either corporate gigs or think tanks, often funded by corporate donors, or, you know, in many cases both. So you have these. I mean, you could. It's not hard to imagine how that would influence the behavior within government of either civilian or military leaders. And then foreign governments, you know, it's also a story that's been told. Mersheimer and Walt written about the Israel lobby, Ukrainian, you know, people talk about Ukrainian propaganda doing very well in the last few months. I think in that case, you know, we wanted to buy into sort of what the Ukrainians were selling. So it was sort of, you know, a symbiotic relationship there. And it's, you know, it's not just foreign governments, you know, sometimes it's just foreigners more generally. So the Ahmed Shalabi, I mean, was an incredibly influential person in influencing the thought and of the people who are more ideologically committed to invading Iraq before the Iraq war, who were sort of happened to be in the right place in the right time after 9/11. And, you know, there, by some accounts, there was a plan to actually put Shalabi, you know, to make him, you know, the leader of Iraq and just get out from Dick Cheney and these other people in the administration. Yeah. And another interesting thing about foreign governments is we have a sanctions regime, and we have a practice of, you know, cutting off countries in diplomatic relations, which means we can, you know, some countries can influence the U.S. and some factions within countries can influence the U.S. and others can't. So it's very interesting. I mean, that Israel and the Saudis, you know, can try to influence American foreign policy, while, you know, Iran doesn't even have direct diplomatic relations, much less, you know, funding think tanks or, you know, are their ambassador speaking on, you know, the news or anything like that. I mean, there's none of that. So there's sort of a, you know, this is actually a very interesting and sort of unique aspect of American foreign policy, where we, you know, open the gates to some foreign influence and then just completely shut off others.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023, and angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web. And in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare20.
So let me just ask you, I'm surprised that you left out of your groups that have unusual influence business and economic interests, because you just mentioned those as explaining the economic engagement with China going back to the 90s. And it seems to me that does a lot better explanation of our posture towards China than any of your explanations. I mean, it's not obvious to me why maybe the national security, why the national security bureaucracy or the defense contractors would be lobbying in favor of that outcome. It seems, as you just said, to be driven by business interests. And I mean, who were the governments lobbying for that? Was it the Chinese, and what kind of influence did they have? So why did you leave economic interests out of your, out of the groups you gave that you elevated as important? And isn't that what really explains our, the economic engagement of China for the last 25 years, at least until the Trump administration?
Yeah. So I think that's a good question. And one reason, you know, and what I say in the book is that I think that the business interests were influential in the case of China because there wasn't a direct immediate term place for the national security interest to have us just have a strong opinion. And so when you go to public choice theory, the idea is that a group is influential if they are a concentrated interest. So they can get a disproportionate share of, you know, whatever benefit is going to come from a policy choice. So if you think about something like Raytheon or Lockheed Martin, they, you know, everything to them, their entire bottom line depends on the defense budget, right? So you might, and if you think about someone like Ahmed Chalabi or something, you know, who was funded by the government itself, actually got started thanks to CIA funding. You know, he wants to be the new president of Iraq. So you could imagine somebody like a country like Taiwan, their existence to a certain extent depends on American foreign policy. So you have these interests that are just have a very deep interest. Now, any particular corporation can try to influence American foreign policy, but it's just one actor in a very wide system. So business as itself is a very diffuse interest. Now, sometimes the reward can be big enough, like opening up China is such a uniquely large reward, right? So you might expect business to act there. And, again, in the 1990s, they weren't like facing head to head with the foreign policy establishment or any of these other concentrated interests. Because, yeah, the Taiwan lobby, but okay, all of American business versus Taiwan, American business can probably gain the upper hand right there. But I think that was a pretty unique case. I mean, I don't think we see a lot of cases like that. Something like opening up China, something like, sanctions on Iran, for example. You know, some businesses have lobbied against sanctions for Iran. Some company could get a benefit from that. But even like if you're like ExxonMobil or something, I mean, that's going to be a small portion of your total global business. And so, I would expect the weapons manufacturers, the federal bureaucracy, I would expect them to have a bigger influence over most things most of the time.
By the way, speaking of sanctions against Iran, isn't that a counterexample to your claim that sanctions don't work? I mean, didn't the sanctions against Iran, you claim later in the book that as an explanation, tell me if I get this wrong, you claim that a piece of evidence that these posited tenets of the grand strategy are not driving U.S. foreign policy is that we keep using economic sanctions and they don't work. But isn't Iran a case that did work in the sense of, I mean, tell me I might be wrong, but wasn't it the pretty severe sanctions that brought them to the negotiating table that led to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action? Is that wrong?
I think that's an accurate interpretation of the course of events. People who've looked seriously at the literature, they find sanctions, usually don't work. Sometimes they say never or almost never. I think that would be going too far. I think in the case of the JCPOA and then, the case of Myanmar, the transition to the democracy that was, aborted recently. I mean, I think that these are cases where at least arguable cases of sanctions working. So, maybe you could say, well, that's, rational, that shows that sanctions can be part of a rational foreign policy, something like grand strategy. But others, there's other counterexamples where it's not like they just don't work. This is not the thing. It's like sometimes you can do things that work or they don't work. It's like they don't even try to make them work. So the Saddam sanctions in the 1990s. I mean, we have documents, and we were able to capture documents and the recordings actually of what the government in Iraq was talking about, in the 1990s and the early 2000s, and they just, they were just sitting there sort of scratching their heads like the Americans won't even talk to us. How can we figure out, how to get on? They cared a lot about the sanctions. The U.S. could have gotten something for sanctions relief. But they did it. I mean, they didn't try. I mean, there was just sort of no interest in doing that. And so this is often, how it works, that's how it works more often than the Iran case. And the Iran case is interesting from a grand strategy perspective, too, because, the next administration came and ripped it up. So you had this sort of, you know, this, you had sanctions, you had this argument working, you had something looking like American grand strategy, but in the end, you know, it was sort of short-term politics and ideology that determined the zigs and zags of Iran policy.
So let's talk about short-term politics in terms of Ukraine. That's exactly what I wanted to ask about. So the question is, what explains the U.S. behavior vis-a-vis Ukraine since Russia invaded it? And how does this fit with your account? And it seems obvious that one of your triad, the weapons manufacturers, are going to be huge beneficiaries. So you can imagine them putting lots of pressure on the government to go in this route. And as you say, there's a tight connection between former DOD officials who work in these companies, so they may have a special influence there. But it's not obvious to me why the U.S. military would really be on board for ramping up, you know, basically what it seems to me, the surprisingly aggressive U.S. assistance to Ukraine. And then I really don't understand, and this gets to the question of what is the mechanism that explains how these various groups influence the president. You were just talking about short-term policy interests. I don't see how Biden's decision to really aggressively engage Russia by helping Ukraine and providing all sorts of other assistance, it seems obviously not to be in his short-term political interest. It seems that it's foreseeably harming the international economy, sparking inflation, further exacerbating supply chain problems and the like. So given all that, that's a stew of things. How does your theory explain or account for the U.S. response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine?
The U.S. response is interesting. I think one of the best things that can be said for the short-term, public choice, short-term political public choice understanding of the the U.S. policy towards Russia and Ukraine is that the sanctions against Russia actually turned out to be tougher than what was promised. So it was up for debate whether SWIFT would be on this table, something like an oil, embargo, which the EU is doing. I mean, this is not just the U.S., this is its allies in Europe too. But you want the point of the sanctions, if it's to deter, you say at least, maybe you exaggerate what you're going to do. You don't downplay what you're going to do. So the U.S. and Europe actually, they surprised everyone by coming out tougher than people expected. And, that's just completely illogical from a strategic perspective.
Much tougher. I mean, especially the central bank stuff.
Yeah, exactly. The weapons provided too. I mean, some of it was maybe the Ukrainians, just fought so well that it changed the political dynamic. But I think the stuff came very, very quickly before we even knew, exactly which way the war was gonna go. So if the Russians did actually just, roll the Ukrainians and take the country, took Kiev, it's interesting to wonder what the response would have been there, because we'd amplified it so much. But I think this pre-negotiation, particularly if you look at those few months before the invasion of Ukraine, I think it says a lot about, I think it's a theory, I think, has a lot to contribute to understanding what was going on. As far as Biden and the administration's current policy, I'm not sure I read the politics in the exact same way. So you can look, there's an argument you can make that says Americans care more about the economy than they do about foreign policy. That's true. And if you put those things head to head, people will choose the economy. At the same time, there is such a thing as sort of the tone of the coverage and how the presidency is understood in a more sort of holistic sense. So I thought that the smart move was to pull out of Afghanistan politically, because people don't care about Afghanistan. But as soon as he pulled out of Afghanistan, Afghanistan became the headlines, and suddenly, the country, the war we'd forgotten about for 15 years, became the main story. And his polling went down. I still think it was probably the right decision, because it's a short-term thing. And, it's better, I guess, to rip the Band-Aid off than continue the war, which might have been the only other option, and take casualties, indefinitely into the future. So maybe it was still the right decision. But you could see how sort of what something that just sort of had a naive look. When you take a naive look at it, you sort of wonder how these things play out, and sort of the tone of the media coverage and the tone of the experts, the people who are on CNN and MSNBC and Fox News. I mean, they tend to be very hawkish people, often part of this military industrial complex that we've been talking about, ex-generals who are now working for some weapons manufacturer. So if Biden just tries to do the best thing for the American economy in the short term, because he wants to do well in the mid midterms and potentially win re-election. Yeah, he just says, you know, Russia, you know, do whatever you want. We're not going to sanction you. We're going to have trade. We're just going to get the grain out. We're going to figure out how to do this. He does that, though. I mean, he'll get killed in the media. I mean, the coverage will become, you know, Russia starts making progress on the battlefield. Russia's economy is not even being hurt. It's not even being punished for this evil act of aggression. I think that becomes the, you know, the biggest story in the country. And I think, you know, that potentially hurts him politically. The Republicans are not going to give him credit for saving the economy and stuff. You know, the Republicans who now say, focus on America, you know, America first, don't focus on Ukraine. If Biden does that, and, you know, Russia starts taking parts of Ukraine and the economy does get better, they're not going to thank him. They're gonna attack him over Ukraine. So I think there's at least an argument to be made that this is what he should be doing politically.
Maybe it's what he should be doing politically in the counterfact. I mean, what you're saying is counterfactually, he would have received lots of political heat if he had not engaged as aggressively as he did. But it just seems to me, maybe I'm wrong about this, that the economic consequences are going to hurt him a lot, especially with the upcoming elections, more than a foreign policy, alleged foreign policy weakness would. But you mentioned Afghanistan and the withdrawal, and that one, I have to say, of all the recent foreign policy events, strikes me as the hardest, you might agree with this, the hardest to square with your theory. It's not something, mm-hmm. You mentioned that two prior presidents had come into office, and indeed, Obama and Trump had both run on trying to shrink the war, and they came in and they were greeted by, and they both tried and they both met resistance from the foreign policy establishment, and they both kind of backed down from their initial efforts. But Biden did it, and he did it, and the DOD didn't want him to do it, and certainly the weapons manufacturers didn't want him to do it, and our allies didn't want him to do it, and yet he did it. So, I mean, I guess, how do you square this? Is it that your theory explains a lot of stuff, but ultimately the president, if he wants to take the heat, can overcome these interests? I mean, how do you square that event with your account of U.S. foreign policy?
Yeah, exactly as you said. I mean, it's not a deterministic formula that you're going to understand what happens in every potential foreign policy decision, only that there is a tendency. So there was a tendency among concentrated interests to want to keep the Afghanistan war going. They kept the war kept going during the Bush administration. They overcame the resistance from two administrations, particularly Trump, I mean, who really, really wanted to get out of Afghanistan, if you read the journalistic accounts and the memoirs of what happened. And then eventually, you know, there was a president who, at some point you just have to understand, you know, there's history. There's something domain specific where something unusual happened, because of some constellation of circumstances. So in this case, it was the fact that Biden, basically since he was the vice president under Obama, he was the most resistant to taking a more hawkish approach to Afghanistan. Biden overruled him. I think Biden, after Obama's surge in Afghanistan, everything got worse. The U.S. started taking more casualties, more territory fell out of the government's hand into the hands of the Taliban. I think Biden felt like he was vindicated by history. I mean, I think he thinks that if they, people would have listened to him, we would have avoided a lot of mess in Afghanistan. And, he comes into office, and, I think he wants to get out. And so it's also, I mean, often these are very tough political decisions because, again, like we said, I mean, it's like the Biden administration, does he take the economic hit with the Russia-Ukraine situation, or does he try to do whatever's best for the economy and take the criticism that he's soft on Russia and letting Putin win, which is also bad politics. I think Biden was also, it's not an easy political decision because the pulling out of Afghanistan hurt. But, the reason the U.S. casualties had gone so low in Afghanistan was because we had an agreement with the Taliban. So what was the alternative to leaving Afghanistan? The alternative might be reneging on the deal that Trump had, and Trump could come back in 2024 and say, I had this deal, and then going back to taking casualties in Afghanistan, this like slow burn, right? That this sort of pointless war that extends forever, that the Taliban, all the momentum had been with the Taliban for, really like pretty much a decade. And so that's not an easy decision too. It's a short-term pain versus long-term pain. And I think he probably actually made the right decision in the end, because he's looking, I think you take the short-term pain over the long-term pain, particularly when you're early in the administration and you're far away from a midterm. I mean, in November, is Afghanistan going to matter? No, it's going to be inflation and other events have happened. It's going to be, what the tone about the Russia and Ukraine coverage, and might be, Roe v. Wade. wait or something like that. But yeah, I think you do it early in your administration, or when you it does give you a framework of when they might do these things. So maybe very early in your administration, you go against sort of the when you're furthest away from election, you go against the concentrated interest, or maybe in your second term at the end of administration. So this is when you got the JCPOA. Remember what Obama criticized for telling Dmitry Medvedev, we're going to have more room to work with you guys, Russians, after the election. So you do have a role for ideology. You do have a role for sort of, the idiosyncrasies and the beliefs of and the ideological commitments of presidents. And, the public choice framework, I think, gives you an understanding of when those things will be more or less important.
So I want to come back to something that we were discussing earlier, Mearsheimer and Walt. It may surprise you that when I was reading your book, I kept thinking about their work and all the points of connection and agreement in their work, but in an odd way. And you alluded to this. I just want to flesh it out. So they're both famous realists, and I think it's fair to say they have a positive or descriptive account of international behaviors based on primarily, I think, international structure, maybe less than some from which they derive national interests. And so they make certain predictions and certain accounts, and it's also a basis for them to have normative critiques. And whether their descriptive and normative claims can be squared, we can talk about that. But what I really want to point out is their theories together, their critiques of U.S. foreign policy are similar to yours. Steve Walt wrote a whole book about the blob and its pernicious influence on U.S. foreign policy and U.S. foreign policy interests, which is two of your three triads, the national security bureaucracy and the national security bureaucracy, the weapons manufacturers, the elite press. I think that's what the basic constitutive parts of the so-called blob that supposedly dominates U.S. foreign policy. So Steve critiqued U.S. foreign policy using that set of interests. Mearsheimer's essay in Foreign Affairs said almost exactly the same thing you did in your book, which is that he was talking about China and how the United States made a huge mistake in engaging China economically and allow it to rise into this huge power that now it has to deal with. And he said that was just a mistake from the realist perspective, and that basically those decisions didn't serve U.S. foreign policy interest. And he explained it in terms of basically a special interest group, which is kind of what you do. And then, as you mentioned, the Israel Lobby book by both Mearsheimer and Walt is basically an account of a foreign government having undue influence on U.S. foreign policy. So what do you mean? First of all, am I right? Are these connections real? And what do you make of them?
Yeah, I mean, I think, one thing I want to do in the book is not just sort of present my theory of American foreign policy. It's to sort of, try to clarify what other people are doing, when they're talking about American foreign policy. Mearsheimer and Walt, I think you're right. I mean, people who've influenced me, I took a class with him at University of Chicago when I was in law school. I took a graduate course with John Mearsheimer. They people like this point out a lot of anomalies and strange things in American foreign policy, things that are destructive and, not sensible from like any kind of rational perspective, in the sense of, actually working towards achieving national goals. And so they're completely right about that. But then the realist theories are supposed to be, they're supposed to be descriptive theories. And, it comes to a point where you say, okay, you have this descriptive theory, and then you spend so much time criticizing the world for not working in accordance with these descriptive theories. It's like, at what point do you think, okay, the theory is not actually itself very useful? So I think, Mearsheimer in particular, I like his work. He's been a big influence on me, but he's also, I think, one difference between me and him is I think that his understanding is based on things like material interest and just power. And so, Mearsheimer, doesn't think, for example, he wouldn't think that the fact that China is a non-democracy has any effect on sort of either their foreign policy or how Americans perceive them. Now, it's hard to say, whether China's foreign policy would be different or how it would be different. But the idea of just somebody who knows American politics, that idea that our public opinion and sort of how American elites see China wouldn't make it, you know, wouldn't be any different if, say, China had a government that just behaved, you know, internally, had the exact same politics of like South Korea or Japan. You know, that's just, you know, contradicts everything that I think we know about American politics. So this led Mersheimer at the collapse of, you know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, to predict that, you know, Germany, reunited Germany, would be seen as a threat by the rest of Europe. You know, he predicted, you know, all these sort of new conflicts based on, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union. And no, it ended up being basically, you know, Russia. It still ended up being Russia and Germany and France. You know, they integrated and were happy to join the EU and give up their sovereignty with, you know, very, very little friction in a grand historical sense. Yeah, I mean, I do think Mersheimer, you know, has good trenchant critiques of American foreign policy, but they're such good critiques that, you know, it sort of calls the entire underlying theory into question.
Yeah. So let me ask you one final question, and that is this. So you were saying earlier, I think in response to my question about the Afghanistan pullout, that your theory doesn't explain everything. You mentioned all sorts of other factors that influence Biden. You know, I think that some of the three factors that you focus on do explain a lot of U.S. foreign policy, especially the tight connection between the defense contractors and the U.S. national security establishment and the government. I think that has to be. And I would also add their connection to the congressional defense committees. That has to be a large explanatory variable for lots of U.S. military related foreign policy stuff. But I came away from your book asking, you know, what is the point of this theorizing? And I've done this myself in the international law context, trying to give a kind of reductive and elegant explanation for international law behaviors. The older I get, the less I think this is really a fruitful thing to be doing. So I'm just wondering, you know, what do you think? And I think it's all too reductive, and this stuff is too complicated. U.S. foreign policy is too complicated. There are too many contingent factors. There are too many unpredictable factors. So do you agree with that or not? But the real question is, what is the point? What is the aim of this theorizing? Either a lot of it seems to me on the descriptive front to really be hidden normative theorizing, that the descriptive claims are the claims that people think explain the world, but they really want the world to be a certain way. So that's not necessarily a coherent set of thoughts, but the big picture question is, what is the point? What is the aim of international relations theory, and what do you think it should be?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. I mean, I think we come at this from a similar perspective. I'm not a big political theory kind of guy. You know, one of the reasons, you know, I sort of grew disillusioned with academia and went into doing other things, more public work, is, you know, I thought that a lot of this theorizing actually wasn't very useful, and there were actually interesting practical questions we should be talking about. And that's the better way to spend one's time if one is going to be a thinker or a writer. So yeah, I agree. You know, I agree with your general orientation there. You know, and so what I'm, you know, I think we do need something resembling a theory to understand these things. So, I mean, you have an implicit understanding of what drives American foreign policy. So if you have, you know, if you have the grand strategy model in your head, you're going to be going back, looking at Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, assuming most people can't go do, you know, deep historical dives into each foreign policy event. I mean, you sort of need a framework to just understand, like, okay, should we have expected some plan like that would explain both the invade, you know, would explain Afghanistan and the decision to stay in Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq and the post Saddam occupation of Iraq? Like, is there, and does this somehow fit with like what the U.S. was thinking about China and Russia at the time? Like, do you go in like looking for evidence that's going to be consistent with that? Or do you approach it like the way we approach domestic politics, where it's like, okay, there's politicians, there's concentrated interest, there's inertia in policy, and let's just sort of explain it there and not expect anything grander, you know, no pun intended, you know, so to speak, no grand strategy. And so I think we have to make a choice here. And I think I think what I'm doing is I'm pushing back, which I think the grand strategy is an implicit, you know, is in a usually implicit theory of how we understand foreign policy. And I think I want something closer to what you want. I want less theorizing. I mean, the things that I'm saying are not revolutionary. Oh, I have this great explanation that's going to, you know, change. I could take a few variables and expect, you know, tell you what foreign policy is going to be. It's like, no, you know, there's we should understand it the way we understand the rest of politics. The concentrated interests, you know, are a huge factor. You know, politicians care about, you know, politics and their approval ratings winning elections. You know, there's no groundbreaking discovery there either. And I think I'm trying to bring sort of our understanding of international relations, foreign policy, you know, down to earth, and public choice theory is just a way to do that and away from that theorizing. So I think we're actually in quite a bit of agreement here.
Then I think we should stop. Richard, thanks very much. I enjoyed your book.
Thank you, Jack. I appreciate it.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, and our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6, called The Aftermath. Check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. You can also buy Lawfare swag at thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.